Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome Joseph Durrell back to the Celeri Report. He's now going to be joining us quarterly. We're very excited about that. And he's just produced two wonderful new books. I've just finished both of them. We're going to be talking about one of them this evening, Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, UFOs, Oligarchs, and Space Secrecy. It's a topic which is of great interest to me, and I know to many of you. I think it's very important, particularly in the financial and investment world right now. And clearly, Dr. Farrell is someone who on the Celeri Report needs no introduction. So without further ado, Joseph, welcome back.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed reading this book.
Well, thank you.
I keep getting amazed. How come I didn't know this? But I want to start off with a quote from somebody who we both have tremendous respect and admiration for, Mr. Richard Dolan, who you draw from his work, as do I. And you start, this is the first quote of the book, and I think it begins to tee up the issue. Let me just read it. UFOs constitute the great whole of contemporary history. We know at the very least that this was a topic of great concern to those at the top of the American national security policy, despite the near complete absence of public references to it. And that's from his book, UFOs in the National Security State. We interviewed him about that book on the Celeri Report, and that's in the archives if subscribers are interested. So UFOs, what is a UFO?
Well, I think we have to look at it from his point of view, and that's kind of what I was attempting to do in the book is delve into his idea of a breakaway civilization and really try to kind of reverse engineer the culture of that group and how it would go about formulating policy and responses to the UFO issue. And basically, I have to agree almost wholeheartedly with his statement. The UFO really is the hidden factor in modern history, and for that matter, it's the hidden factor in modern historiography, which is yet another thing altogether. But if we look at it from the point of view of what's beginning to happen after the end of World War II, we see, as I outline it, as I think is going on, and he may take issue with some of these details, but this is more or less what I think is going on. You have, first of all, the emerging Cold War, and this is really the matrix in which this national security structure is established and in which it thinks. Because what they are going to attempt to do is contain communism without a direct confrontation or another world war, and then gradually roll it back. And this means they have to create a huge national security structure. They have to create new technologies to monitor the Soviet Union, what they're up to. And this is going to require a lot of money. But in addition to this, Catherine, and I think the money aspect here is where we have to go, because this impacts down to our own day, I think, the fundamental things that we see going on, at least in hints and indications in some of the financial activity in the world and geopolitical activity. But the second thing that impacts the formation of this group greatly and tremendously, in my opinion, this is where I part company with much of modern ufology, is that in my research I've come to the conclusion that after World War II, Nazism survived, and it survived not just in little isolated enclaves huddling and protecting itself for survival, but as an organized financial underground political entity of its own, kind of an extraterritorial state with its own deep inroads into that post-war American national security structure. And I also believe that it continued independently to research some of its advanced technologies. And that, of course, also required a great deal of money. So I've argued in my various books, to make a very long story short, that this twin necessity on the part of this post-war Nazi group and on the part of the American national security establishment led them to make common cause in certain areas over a prolonged time. And much of it had to do with finances. Much of it had to do with granting covert access on the part of the American branch of this post-war national security setup to Axis loot. And this is the real beginning of the story. Because, as I've outlined in these books, and as you know, the president at that time, President Truman, took the decision to create basically a vast hidden system of finance using this Axis loot, not only from Europe, but from the Japanese, and keep it top secret. So in other words, he puts the American intelligence community immediately into the role of international bankers, running a huge system of hidden finance.
Right.
So we'll get back to that part of the story. The third aspect that they're all confronted with, the long-term threat, is the UFO. And the reason why you cannot subscribe the UFO phenomenon strictly to Nazis or any other terrestrial basis, although I believe that there is some of that activity involved, the reason why, as I outlined in this most recent book, is there's simply too many UFOs to be accounted for on the basis of limited production facilities that the Nazis or the Russians or anybody else on Earth would have had to produce this stuff.
Right. If you look at our industrial capacity,
right,
and if you look at how much money was going into the black budget,
right,
it's not enough.
It's not enough.
It's not enough.
It's not enough. And, you know, I make the argument that it's really not the technological aspect of the UFO that's the problem. It's the production of it. It's,
right.
It's very expensive.
And the financing.
And the financing, exactly.
And the financing, right.
So, you know, I do agree with ufologists that state that you cannot subscribe all UFO activity simply to hidden black projects on Earth because there's too much of it.
Right.
So this national security establishment really has three threats that they've got to look at and deal with all at the same time. They've got the communist bloc. They've got this Nazi group that, you know, on Monday they're in bed with and on Tuesday they're arguing with, you know. So that's the second problem. But the long-term problem is the UFO. And this means that they've got to create a huge Manhattan-style project that is of much longer duration than the Manhattan Project, and it's going to require much more money, and it's not going to be a project that they can simply draw on normal black budget or unvouchered funds sources of funding. They have literally got to create a hidden system of finance to do this, and that's what they did. So I think, you know, this is the story, at least a key principal part of the story, that's been hidden from people's attempts to analyze the geopolitical situation, the financial situation, and so on. So I'm in 100% agreement with Mr. Dolan on that assessment.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I came to this from following the fraud.
Right.
So I kept trying to understand why all the efforts to clean up the fraud over many decades. You'd see people come into government or come into business. They would be very effective people and very effective at cleaning up the fraud. And it was like they would bounce off a force field. And if you looked at the force field implementing the fraud, it wasn't, you know, it was across the system. It was a matter of policy. It was built into the infrastructure. And it had enormous support from a wide variety of very intelligent, seemingly honorable constituents. And when you dug down and started to research, well, why were all these people going along with, you know, opening America up to narcotics trafficking, all these different things? What you would hear was, we had no good option. This was the best of a group of bad options.
Right.
You know, in other words, it keeps coming back, we had to do it, we had to do it, there was no choice, we had to do it. And what you see over many, many decades is, of course, unfortunately, you describe three enemies, it turns, you know, it's the creation of a fourth enemy, which is a general population who doesn't understand what's going on, and the more and more they become intellectually and culturally separate, the more they are seen as dangerous and an enemy just because they don't know and they're naive.
Right, and I'm glad that you mentioned this, because this is the other kind of hidden theme to this most recent book, because I think that there are signs and indicators within this technocratic financial national security oligarchy, particularly in this country, that see this as a problem and are trying to move away from that paradigm. In other words, there is a group, as we both know, that does see the general population of this country, and for that matter the rest of the world, as a threat and just wants to eliminate it. But I think the same people in that oligarchical group are seeing that they cannot afford to do that. It would be suicidal for them and their class interest, their factional interest, to do so. So I think that they are taking steps to gradually bring people into some sort of limited knowledge and participation in this system, which I think, as we will continue talking tonight, I think we're kind of both agreed they're trying to restructure in significant ways.
Right.
But this third enemy, the UFO, is really the problem. It's the ultimate problem lying behind this vast system of fraud and financial incest is about the only way I can qualify it, because by tapping into this vast system of Axis loot and using it to leverage the system of finance, what they've done is recognize that the UFO is a phenomenon that they're going to have to bluff their way through a very dangerous period of human history in order to achieve some sort of technological parity or emulation of the phenomenon. And at that point, I think when they get close to that point, and I think they already are, which is why I think we're seeing the changes that we're seeing, when they get close to that point, they are going to loosen up their hold on some of the technologies that they've been developing. They've had to emulate a phenomenon at breakneck speed, and all indications, in my opinion, Catherine, are there that they've caught up rather quickly to what the UFO phenomenon represents. So, yeah, it's a huge, huge story.
I want to jump back, because I've never, you know, many times I've gone down the rabbit hole of trying to understand what the UFO phenomena is.
Yes.
And I've never been able to come to any conclusion.
Right.
But, and one of the things you do in the book is you do walk through some of the options, but I wanted to just list out, for purposes of this conversation, the people listening, what some of the options are. Okay,
well,
so.
Yeah, the UFO, I don't think we can qualify it as a phenomenon. I think
right.
We're dealing with phenomena.
Right.
I do think there are three basic hypotheses for the origin of these things. The first is, of course, that they're extraterrestrials, are coming from some other planet from elsewhere, and they're arriving here with a nuts and bolts technology. And again, if you examine the UFO record, there are certainly indicators that that is a viable hypothesis. But then you have the phenomenon of abductions and missing time and things of this sort, plus some very, very strange behavior on the part of UFOs that indicates we might be dealing with actual living beings of some sort. You know, the ancient texts would call them angels or jinns or what have you, or intelligences or disembodied spirits, what have you. There's some indication for that hypothesis. And certainly what I'm trying to indicate here is that the breakaway group would have had to consider and respond to all of those hypotheses.
Unless they knew.
Unless they knew for sure which
right.
one or set of them was what they were dealing with. Now, I'm still in the old kind of flying saucer camp. I'm in the camp that tends to think that insofar as UFOs represent a technology that is not human, that they're coming here from somewhere else, some other planet, some other star system perhaps, who knows. But these are the options. The final option, one that doesn't get mentioned, but I believe for the sake of completeness, it has to be mentioned. And that is that whoever's behind the UFO may still be here, may be, you know, in the oceans, may be subterranean on Earth. And in addition to this, if you look at ancient texts, and this has been a big part of my work from the very beginning, If you look at some ancient texts, you'd certainly include the Bible in that. You'd include Mesopotamian texts, Egyptian texts, Vedic, and so on and so forth. In other words, all of these human traditions seem to indicate or suggest that the gods, the angels, whatever you wish to call them, had some sort of genetic relationship to humanity. And I often refer to this idea as our cousins, because in order for the types of stories, you know, the inbreeding in Genesis 6 in the Old Testament that most people would be familiar with, modern science would tell us that in order to have that capability, you have to have a genetic resemblance. You have to be of the same genus. And you can find UFO documents, in fact, that purport to be from this secretive UFO group that indicate precisely this phenomenon. They talk about the human genus or the human form being somehow a part of a higher biological order. And what they're suggesting when they say that is precisely this idea that we may be visited by a branch of the human family that has forgotten about us, or that we've forgotten about, whatever. So you've got all of these different hypotheses about what the UFO is.
Let me just jump back to one, because sure. I think the interdimensional one.
Yes.
My understanding is, you know, there are people who think that's time travel.
Right.
And in fact, you know, that interdimensional travel and time travel is essentially the same hypothesis.
It's the same thing.
Right.
And this, it's interesting you mentioned that one, because I'm coming to entertain that hypothesis a little bit more seriously. The reason I intended up till very recently to dismiss that is in the standard model of physics, to open up those kinds of interdimensional membranes or portals would just require, as Art Bell used to say, a gymungus amount of energy. And it's, you know, and the other problem with wormholes and that sort of thing is wormholes are a billion times tinier than tiny. So,
right.
You know, getting anything other than a little droplet of information through one of those things is another little tiny problem. But there's other reasons I'm coming more to entertain that idea. We'll probably talk about them privately sometime. But the other thing about the interdimensional hypothesis, the reason I put that in there was precisely because it's usually under that rubric that you find people entertaining the idea of ancient contact that's been preserved in human legends and traditions and various texts and so on, you know, like the story in Genesis 6. But, you know, we have to understand that story in the Bible is one literally of virtually hundreds that are out there in other traditions. So I think the breakaway group would have been hard-pressed not to consider all of these possibilities. It would have been very hard-pressed, and in fact, I think it made a major effort to understand the historical record from this point of view of some of these ancient legends and texts and traditions. But for its part, I think the bottom line about the UFO is that it represented a technological threat to the national security and, more importantly, to the planet. And therefore, they had, first of all, to understand the phenomenon as best as they could, and then try to reverse engineer it and emulate the technological performance.
One of the things I want to mention, because it's not necessarily understood by people who haven't thought about these issues, is the history of a technologically superior society meeting a technologically inferior society. That story is never good for the technologically inferior society.
No, it isn't.
And, it's never.
Never. And this is the, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because this is really kind of the major theme of this book. Because what I'm trying to show in the book is that because of human nuclear achievement and UFOs, this is the other thing the national security apparatus would have noticed immediately, is that UFOs show an inordinate amount of interest in human defense installations that deal either with the manufacture, the storage, or the possible deployment of nuclear weapons. And this would have been an immediate concern to them. And they would have asked the question, well, why? because obviously humanity did not at that time, nor does it now, at least as far as we're told, have the capability of delivering those weapons to any non-terrestrial target.
And well, we sent a nuclear bomb to the moon recently.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to that. There's a lot more going on, but I'm talking in terms of the 40s and 50s when they're formulating their policy. They're going to be wondering, well, why are they so concerned about nuclear weapons? And the conclusion I've come to is that nuclear weapons represented a breakaway. Or pardon me, a gateway technology to other capabilities. This would have been the conclusion of the national security establishment, in my opinion, for various reasons that I outline in the book. And once they come to that conclusion, then they come to the conclusion, well, that means that we are not all that far behind whoever is behind these.
Joseph, what about the theory that whether it's they're here, you know, it's a whether it's a race of humans or someone else who's subterranean or time travel, it's somebody who can't afford for us. If we blow ourselves up, we may blow up them or some of their operations, so they can't afford.
I think that that's a possibility, too. I think all of these things are possibilities. And, and they all play ultimately into the idea that the nuclear technology is a gateway to greater possibilities. And that means that the national security establishment would have concluded that whoever's behind this technology, insofar as they're not human, whoever's behind it is not millions or millennia or even hundreds of years ahead of us, but perhaps only decades. And that therefore it is within the realm of possibility that we can catch up and emulate the phenomenon very quickly. But in the meantime, this means for them that we go through a period of risk and danger, and that period is suggested precisely by the ancient texts. I call it the Tower of Babel moment. Because in every version, not just the biblical, but in every version of this moment in ancient history, humanity, for whatever reason, is in some sort of state of social and political unity, economic unity, and has tremendous technological ability that is a threat. And of course, in every version of the story, you have God or the gods stepping in to intervene, break up humanity into tribes or nations, if you will, and basically sabotage the technological threat. So I think that's the way that this breakaway group would have read the record. So they also had to use this vast system of funding and finance not only to create technologies, but I think to a certain extent, Catherine, to wage a kind of psychological operation against the folks, whoever they may be, behind the UFO phenomenon, not just covert operations against the communists. And that's another, you know, that's another part of the story.
Because the thing that makes geopolitics complex.
Yes.
Is if you have whoever's doing the UFOs, whoever that is, can certainly make crazy between different geopolitical interests, and it can make everyone much more insecure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now we're seeing a very interesting thing happen, and I noticed in your outline that you sent me that you wanted to talk about interest and investment in space.
Right.
Because this is where I think we begin to see how this hidden group may be gradually unraveling or unrolling some of their hidden agendas over the past few decades, and particularly within the geopolitical context and what they're up to. Way back in covert wars and breakaway civilizations, I argued that this hidden system of finance may very well have been set up with the cooperation of a few prime banks around the world on the basis of collateralizing whatever would be found in space.
All right.
So in other words, this whole effort was privatized very early on, and that's a key component here, because it's the privatization that really goes and addresses the issue of UFO secrecy directly. It's not so much the government covering this stuff up, but it's big major corporate and financial interests with a stake in this from the get-go.
Right, and I just want to say one thing. One of the most important things to understand about American history is that literally 1947 to 1955, the government lost control of the technology.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree.
Right.
And I think it's because of this hidden system of finance that was set up and the decision at that very early date that I argue, of course I have no direct evidence for this, but I argue that space was collateralized very early on. Well, what do we see happening now? We see two things. In fact, Catherine, in just the last 2 weeks, and I've been blogging about this and have some more things coming up for the next week, we've seen two things happening, stories happening, that are kind of in the news, but they're just below the main stories of the day. The first is all of the talk that we've seen about mining asteroids. And interestingly enough, I just ran an article on my website about the Japanese space agency, JAXA, has now just tested a little satellite space probe that has a cannon.
Right, it's a space cannon.
It's a space cannon, yeah. And
right.
And what we're being told is that this thing is supposed to be a space cannon to go up and punch holes in asteroids so that we can mine it. All right, now, I hope people just caught what's going on here, because there's been a lot of talk about asteroid mining on the various space agency sites, Roscosmos and the European Space Agency and JAXA and so on. They're all talking about this, NASA especially.
Right.
And the Japanese come along and say, oh, by the way, we've got a space cannon. And we're testing it, and it worked out okay, and now we're going to put it up there, and we're going to go blast asteroids, okay? Now, as all of this is going on, what else is happening? Well, just in the last 2 weeks, Catherine, something else amazing, and this is UN-sponsored talks between Russia and the United States to create an asteroid defense system. Now, the reason I find all of this amazing is, number one, if you're going to collateralize space, let's go back and pretend we're Venice, okay, which we can do in this context rather conveniently. Because what happens in Venice? Well, you've got a bunch of bankers on the Rialto. They agree to float loans to send the galleys to go pick up gold bullion and slaves and spices from the Middle East and bring them back to Venice. And the collateral is what is brought back, okay?
Right.
So this is exactly what we see happening now in terms of space. But what else does Venice do? You cannot be a maritime power without being a major military power. So Venice, of course, creates the state arsenal to build its military galleys to protect its shipping, and they manage to lead the armaments revolution, really, that begins in late Renaissance Europe and continues up to our modern time. We see the same thing here. So in other words, the collateralization of space implies, by necessity, the militarization of space. But
right.
Now you have to ask the question, well, against whom? It's very significant and telling to me, Catherine, that the UN is sponsoring these Russian-American negotiations to create this quote-unquote asteroid defense system, because the implication is that in terms of geopolitics, geopolitics has now become cosmopolitics.
Right.
And the implication is there's somebody out there that they have to protect against. that's to me what's really interesting here. And we're being told in very subtle ways that the UFO, just as Mr. Dolan said, is really the hidden story here.
So I wanted to bring up one point that I think is for people who want to follow this and learn more. One of the most important books to my thinking on this was one you described in the Covert Wars, and that's Norman Berglund's Rings of Saturn.
Oh, yes.
And the reason is he was an engineer at Lockheed and at Ames Laboratory.
Right.
And he saw all the Voyager photos. And, of course, now the official story is, oh, as the Voyager passed Saturn, it broke, you know, the photos, the camera broke and we couldn't get anything in.
Right.
That's the latest from Popular Mechanics. But he wrote it. Of course, that's not true. And he wrote a book describing the fact that they proceed to see what they think are literally spaceships that are 20,000 plus miles long, made of plasma, living, growing, organic kind of things that can travel. But now, here's what's interesting. That was 8081. That's right. Exactly when the fraud exploded and things became completely bizarre.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh,
yeah,
if you look
at his dates and the Voyager probe and how that parallels against Iran-Contra.
87, 88, that's right.
What happened was, though, that if you talk to the guys who were doing the Iran-Contra fraud at that time, what they say is, they were sent out to go get as much money as they could. And they couldn't believe they were getting away with the fraud, and it just grew and grew and grew, and it exploded. But it was really, the push began in 81, 82. Right then.
Oh, and the other thing we have to bear in mind is President Reagan's Star Wars speeches, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. So the way it tracks is quite remarkable. The other dates I wanted to bring up was, of course, President Obama announcing and sort of pushing through this policy at NASA and in the U.S. government that space will be private and a private affair.
Yes.
NASA and the government continue to fund it. But just as Obama is on one hand delivering the money to the bankers to close out all the fraud that's been used to do the financial coup d'etat, he's setting up the space agency so all that money can be reinvested in a way that will make private profits.
Right, exactly.
Right,
exactly.
And I'm sure most people are looking at it thinking the two have nothing to do with each other.
No.
To me, it's all part of a 1-2 punch.
Oh, yeah. This is the important thing I think people have to take away from our discussions here, Catherine, and that is we're looking at things from a very long point of view and on a very big canvas.
Right.
Really a point of view that goes back at least as far as World War II, if not before, and continuing up to the present. And it's when you look at these kinds of synchronicities, the explosion of the fraud, which I hadn't thought about, and thank you for mentioning, the explosion of the financial fraud that you see going on in the late 1980s in the Reagan administration, and his Star Wars speech and his strange speeches about being invaded by aliens from another planet. All of that, I think, is playing into this, and I think we're seeing with these stories about asteroid defense and joint American-Russian initiatives and space collateralization and asteroid mining, which cinches it for me. That's your collateralization right there. I think we're seeing the gradual rollout of at least some of this hidden structure that was put into place to deal with the UFO.
Well, I also think, let's turn to the building out of the U.S. infrastructure.
Yes.
Because there are hundreds of signs that you see either driving around the country or as you explore what's happening in various different industries, particularly technology and innovation.
Right.
You literally see a lot of money coming in onshore. And of course, I think it's a lot of it is the money that's been shifted out of the retirement systems one way or the other.
Right.
And it's, we are literally reinventing, redeveloping, rebuilding a number of the critical industries and it looks to me like creating a whole new industrial platform, and it's very much centric to North America. And my guess is that we're talking about trillions of dollars being reinvested to build out a new platform.
I agree with you. We've discussed this scenario, and I've mentioned it in a couple of blogs that there appears to be an effort to retrench and to rebuild. And I think we have to entertain a number of possibilities as to what and why this is taking place. The first possibility that all of this raises to my mind, Catherine, is I've been maintaining since the bailouts that we're watching, in a certain sense, we're watching the New World Order unravel, because what we're seeing as they get closer to their goal, we're seeing the inevitable human nature come into the fore as each faction wants to be the dominant one. But the other thing I think we're seeing, not only is factional infighting, I think, and we've discussed this, you and I, before, that the American component of this financial elite vastly overplayed its hand in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and suddenly found themselves overextended and with old allies that are now increasingly sounding less like allies.
Right.
And they're having to retrench for that reason. There's a third thing going on, I think, that we have to bear in mind, too, and that's the pressure against the dollar as the world reserve currency. And I think this is playing into their considerations as well. Because as long as the dollar is the reserve currency, it means to a certain extent it's always going to be overvalued. When it's overvalued, you lose manufacturing and so on and so forth. So I think we're also looking at them realizing that that status cannot be maintained forever. And as a result, they're kind of anticipating events and trying to make the transition period by retrenching manufacturing into North America as smooth as possible. I think there's a hidden story here that might even be related to the UFO, because as you know, the International Monetary Fund has been pressing for a number of years to create its special drawing rights as kind of a global reserve basket of currencies,
right,
based on the dollar, the pound, the euro, the yen, and now the Chinese certainly are making noises that they want the yuan to be included in that basket of currencies. Well, the interesting thing, if you go back in history, and I know that you're familiar with this, that John Maynard Keynes at the Bretton Woods Agreement wanted to create a similar type of currency called Bancor, based on not a basket of currencies, but a basket of commodities. In other words, he wanted a genuine value-backed currency. And this, of course, has been the problem with our monetary system for some decades. It's not backed by any value. It's monetized debt. So the other thing that I think we may be looking at here in the context of our space scenario is, if you have space collateralization and if you have moves to militarize space for the express purpose of protecting the assets that you plan to develop and bring online against someone, you are also implying the possibility, and this will sound very radical, of trade with whoever. And if you're going to have that, you have to have something of value. And if you have trade, of course, you have to have some medium of exchange in order to do it. So we may be even looking behind all of these currency maneuverings, we may even be looking at the creation of something that is not so much meant to ameliorate financial and geopolitical considerations just on this planet, but elsewhere as well. So, you know, there's all sorts of angles to this.
Well, one of the things, you know, one of my concerns about talking about these matters for years has always been, you know, we see this in the report from Iron Mountain, and you describe it in your book, that E.T. would always be the excuse, you know, if when the war on drugs and the war on poverty and the war against communism and the war on terrorism and all those things showed up as being as silly as they are, you know, where's the next war? And if you look at the string of all the alien movies coming out, you know, I think, oh, no, they're setting up the next round of disinformation and the next round of war. Because in fact, space exploration will replace, you know, would in theory replace war as the sort of controlling thing to keep the economy pumped up and centralized forces in control.
Oh, well, I think that you're absolutely onto something there. And this brings up a major part of the book that you just read. And that is that if you're the National Security Establishment and you're collecting all these UFO reports, the first thing that you're dealing with is not only their interest in nukes, but there are other, you know, hundreds of reports of hostile UFO action against human aircraft, trains, installations, human beings. And whether real or not, the problem is I shouldn't have said real or not, but whether they're technological or interdimensional or not, the National Security Establishment is going to have to view that as a threat.
Right.
And it is going to have to respond accordingly. And it's got to show enough backbone to stand up to it, but at the same time, it can't afford to get us into any actual shooting war until humanity is in the position to hold its own. Now, let's go back to something that you mentioned earlier, and that was President Reagan, that whole financial fraud emerging in the late 1980s at the same time that you had Berggren discovering all of these things from the Voyager photos. We have to remember something that Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso wrote in his book, The Day After Roswell. Now, let me preface what I say here by a caveat. I am not endorsing his book, nor its conclusions, nor the basic broad scenario he outlines in it. Anybody who's read my book, Roswell and the Reich, will understand why I say that. But one of the very interesting things he does intimate in that book is that Reagan's Star Wars program was less about defending against the Soviet Union and more about the UFO issue. And that by that time in history, the national security establishment had been successful in stalemating, those are kind of his words, in stalemating the situation vis-a-vis the UFO. So all of this is very suggestive of, I think, the idea that we're looking at a financial system that makes no sense.
Right.
If you look at it solely from a terrestrial and earthbound geopolitical perspective, it begins to make a lot of sense when you add in this hidden system of finance, the UFO issue, space collateralization, asteroid defense, and all of that. It really begins to make sense.
Well, you're centralizing the economy,
yes,
at a speed and in a way which is destructive of wealth. And someone,
yes,
only does that if they are feeling very insecure.
Yes.
They need to move quickly to get as much control as fast as control.
Absolutely.
Now, I can come up with a hypothesis that says if you're the Anglo-American Alliance, you want to continue to maintain your leadership of,
right,
financial flows. And so, you know, I can come up with a,
sure,
you know, some theories to support it. But if you look at the amount of money that they're basically generating from fraud,
yeah,
it's too much to be explained just by that.
It is. And the other problem is it is a system that ultimately depends on, well, let me back up. Someone said to me once when I first outlined that hypothesis, Catherine, but Dr. Farrell, that system won't work. And my response was, and this is something very important for people to understand, my response to that was, I know it won't work. I'm not telling you what will work. I'm telling you this is what they did.
Well, but they don't necessarily need it to work forever. They need to work it for the next phase.
That's right. It only needs to work for as long as they need it to work,
right,
to get the technologies and so on and so forth. And this is why I think it's breaking down. I think Russia's moves, China's moves, vis-a-vis space, this little Japanese space cannon, these are little subtle clues from the other players on the block, so to speak, that they know what the game is.
Well, the pushback is enormous.
Yeah, the pushback is enormous.
The pushback is enormous, and maybe I'll jump ahead. I want to come back and walk through the U.S. infrastructure and industry, but you and I have talked several times about, you know, sort of the networks of U.S. intelligence and some of the,
yes,
secret societies and the telecoms basically getting a control file and intelligence network through digital means that sort of for the first time in 2,000 years outdoes the Catholic churches and the Vatican's,
yes,
networks, which have,
yes,
always been the, you know, the superior intelligence and sort of local place-based, you know,
right,
controlling network. And so suddenly we see through digital communications, you know, this other group jump the curve. And we know that they've been extremely hard on the Vatican. The Vatican's taken it on the chin for all the pedophilia and control file stuff, you know, throughout,
right,
the developed world. And now this starts, and I keep looking at it, and I can only figure, you know, that the Vatican has rounded up every person who wants to push back.
Yeah.
And they're pushing back with a mighty force. And, you know, it reminds you of how powerful they are.
Well, they are very powerful. And there have been recently rumors to this effect that there's some pushback from the Vatican. I suspect ultimately that the Vatican is going to play a major role in this, but for a very different reason, one that I began to outline way back in Babylon's Banksters, and that is the traditional association of high finance and banking with religion, with the temple. And this is why I think the Vatican is going gangbusters in its attempt to clean up and clean out the Vatican Bank and to reassert its control over that institution. Because the Vatican Bank has been a pivot in this hidden system of finance. And to illustrate that, I go back to something I mentioned in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations. Hirohito, Emperor Hirohito, placed a lot of his liquid assets that he gained from this vast suctioning of bullion and precious gems and paper currencies and securities out of Asia during World War II. He placed some of that money in the Vatican Bank. So in other words, it is a key component of the hidden financial structure.
And here's what I believe is it's reached a point where, one, it's an invaluable piece of the structure from a variety of different strategic
yes.
viewpoints, but it's reached a point where it could cost the Vatican and the Church its entire brand.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it has.
Right.
It has, and they must clean it up.
Right.
We've talked about what I think the election of Francis means, and it means quite literally the recognition. This is a long-term transitional papacy. It means the recognition on the part of the Cardinal Curia that it cannot continue to have a Eurocentric version of Catholicism, and that it must relocate, or quite literally relocate, its sphere of influence and power to the second and third world.
Right.
This represents a long-term strategic change, and thus far, every move that I've seen Francis make seems to confirm that indication.
Well, it's funny. All these institutions that decided to rebalance the global economy...
Right.
The global economy is now rebalancing them.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. You know, this is the thing that they don't like. Market forces are always going to trump whatever they do.
Right. It's funny. I was just having an argument with one of my partners about that because, you know, the nature of these politics is it's like riding a bucking bronco, you know?
Yeah.
And and the different forces think that they're good at predicting the bronco and riding it and manipulating it, and it's kind of a back and forth between sticking their spurs in and the, and
yep,
the bronco.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the North American infrastructure, because that's one of the things I've been trying to understand
mm-hmm.
in my work, and I wanted to just go through a couple things. We started to see in 2005 the real dramatic effort to create domestic energy self-sufficiency, at least with fossil fuel.
Yes.
We're also seeing a lot of investment in renewables. So it's a mixed portfolio, but we've now reached a point, I just had a chart up on the blog showing that we have reached a net neutral on we are not dependent as a sort of in a net way on imports of global energy.
That's very interesting.
Right. So we are net energy neutral. Now, obviously, we're exporting a lot and importing a lot. So it's,
right.
you know, it's we're much more interdependent than that implies. But we and you see this in the change in the politics between us and the Middle East and the Saudis.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Because in theory, we can begin to tell them to go jump in a lake.
Yep. Yeah. I think that's partly what's gone on here with the Obama administration in Syria and the Saudi response. I have to admit that I'm a bit puzzled about what is going on in D.C. regarding foreign policy and geopolitics. I suspect very strongly that they may have been successful in staving off a couple of coup attempts, to be quite honest with you. But that's neither here nor there. When we look at the North American energy infrastructure, I think what is really going to cinch the case, Catherine, that we're trying to make, that we're seeing some massive effort, quiet, but nevertheless massive, to retrench and build up the North American power base, is if we start seeing new refineries and a relaxation of regulation on the building and location of refineries. For me, that's going to tear it. Right now, we're seeing the production capacity ratcheted up tremendously. And if it's followed by a refining capacity, this means that the intention is to create a kind of an autarchical energy regime in North America. And that's very significant, because that would mean, as you say, they are even, if we're less dependent right now on Middle Eastern oil, we are still to a certain extent dependent on overseas refining capacity.
Right.
And to me, the real significant change is if our analysis is correct, then we're going to see over the next, I would imagine, 3 to 5 years, new expansion of refinery capacity. This has got to happen if they're serious about this retrenchment.
Well, the other thing you've seen, and this is very long-lived now for over a decade, very interesting patterns in the investment in transportation, including railroads.
Yeah.
We're seeing Buffett and Carlyle buy up railroads, Buffett taking the big one private.
Right.
You know, you know, that to me is a very interesting development, because you're talking about a pretty sleepy industry that every sign looks to me it's beginning to get a lot less sleepy.
It's beginning to get a lot less sleepy, and I suspect, like you, I suspect this is part of the retrenchment. You're going, in our model, what we've been suggesting is that the effort to retrench quickly, the effort to create a central economy quickly, and to bring on 3D printing online, you're looking at people in a hurry that are under some sort of pressure and duress.
Right.
And if you're going to have that kind of dispersed manufacturing base, you must have a transportation infrastructure that can move around raw materials rather quickly. It's not the finished product, it's the raw material. And railroads, we both know, are by far and away the most efficient means to move a lot of stuff very quickly at very low cost.
Right.
The other thing I suspect is going to happen, and this is going to sound wild and crazy, but the other thing I suspect is going to, and it's interesting you mentioned railroads, because I was thinking about that, then I got your outline. And railroads are going also, I think, to be the coming favored method of people transport over long distance. I think it's going to be an inevitability of higher fuel prices. It's going to be, as far as the elite's concerned, it's going to be a much easier way to control the movement of large numbers of people and make a profit from it, which, you know, right now they're kind of at the whim of the individual driver. They're making profit, but not in the way that they'd like to. I think it's a security measure in addition to a transport and infrastructure measure. I think that's coming down the pike. We've already seen these multi-billion-dollar projects for high-speed rail that are simply not going to get off the ground because market realities right now don't exist for them to. But I think they're coming down the pike.
Right, and I think a lot of these things, whether it's Elon Musk talking about maglev trains, or, you know,
right,
you pick up Popular Mechanics or Wired Magazine, and there's tons of articles on space. I think a lot of this is making something fashionable.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not necessarily about something that's going to happen in the next 10 years, but
no,
it's about making it fashionable and getting young people interested in working and going at those things.
Exactly.
And being part of those industries.
Exactly.
Right.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, I'm old-fashioned. I like train travel.
So, oh, I love trains. I love trains.
Yeah.
Another one, which I don't necessarily understand exactly how it fits in, is the centralization of agriculture. And I think part of it is a decision to do everything they can to put America in a position to be the export capital, you know, the breadbasket of the world.
Right.
And have, if you look at the combination of land and water we have, really have lots of global interests needing and being dependent on us.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think this has been the hidden agenda behind GMOs, quite frankly, all along.
Right.
This is to expand the control of the food supply and center it, quite as you have just pointed out, center it on North America. I suspect, and this is, you know, since we're indulging in high octane speculation, but you know, you have to consider these wild and woolly scenarios, because that essentially is what these elites do behind the closed doors. But I've suspected another agenda may be afoot here with GMOs, and let's go back to the what I call the cosmopolitical situation. Okay.
Right.
If you look at the areas on planet Earth that are arable land, you have a few concentrated areas, North America being one, the European breadbasket from the North German plain on into the Ukraine and so on in Eurasia, and Brazil and certain areas in India, and that's it, you know, the breadbasket, plus the world's oceans. Now, if you take that kind of analysis and extend it to local space, what do you have? Well, you have nine planets that are fairly inhospitable, but one of them is just sticking out like a sore thumb.
Uh-huh.
of resources and water and plants and food, you know. Hopefully we're not on the menu, but the problem here is, since we're entertaining the idea of space collateralization and space defense and the possibility of actually trading with somebody else out there, if it's not already underway, then the other thing that you have to have, as we've said, is something of value, and food would certainly be that. And as far as we know, most, I'm not in the camp that says intelligent life could be reptilian or insectoid or any of that. I do think there's a kind of divine, or if you will, evolutionary imperative that evolves to similar forms of life to accomplish similar things. And again, there are early UFO documents suggesting that the elite came to a similar conclusion about the human form very early on in its dealings with the UFO phenomenon. So they're going to require food. And, you know, like it or not, if there's anybody out there between here and Alpha Centauri, planet Earth is a plumb little piece of real estate.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I always struggle with, every time I've tried to understand this, you know, the story of a group from the U.S. Navy and one of the think tanks that serves the Navy trying to persuade me in 1998 that aliens existed and lived among us.
Right.
And I was invited to have lunch with the alien. I said, well, you know, I just don't know that E.T. exists and lives among us. I just don't know that. Right. And I had this image of, you know, oh, this is where they're finally going to make me look like a fool. Mm-hmm. And so he said, would you like to have lunch with some aliens? And I just said, you know, I'm just managing too much risk right now to be seen lunching with aliens. You know, and I always to this day wonder what would have happened. But so I started to read, and I really took it seriously. And I said, okay, I'm going to try and break this down and understand this phenomenon, which is why one of the reasons I love your books is you're so good at framing the uncertainty.
Right.
And taking a subject where we just don't have hard information.
Right.
And framing it and saying, okay, here's what we've got. What patterns do we see? And given what we do know, what does this mean? You know,
right.
So we know in all cases we've got a big financial drain going
right.
on.
Right.
You know, whatever this is, it's expensive.
Right. Well, this, you put it exactly right. It's a matter of framing uncertainties. And I had to put myself in the position of reverse engineering the culture of this elite technocratic group. And I came to the conclusion that whether or not they had proof of an extraterrestrial existence or even presence on this planet, they had to behave as if it was real.
Right.
Because they were confronted with a phenomenon that their attempts to rationalize on the basis of a solely terrestrial origin simply couldn't work. So, yeah,
Okay, so let's go through what we know. Mm-hmm. We know the phenomena is real.
Yes.
The phenomena is real. You've seen UFOs. I've seen, I told you about that night I was driving across North Carolina, and it's not just one, it was hundreds of them.
Yeah.
It's like, what a minute, is the whole universe arriving here to land, or, are they all, do we have a condo association up here in North Dakota? So the phenomena is real, and if you look at how much it's been documented, it's incredible.
Right.
And what percentage of people have seen a UFO? I mean, it's quite amazing.
It's amazing.
Evidence is overwhelming.
Yeah, it is.
This is a heavily documented phenomena. Okay, so number one, the phenomena is real. Number two is we know that it is causing, it has a great deal to do with how the financial system operates.
Yes.
Okay. So this is something that is having a major financial impact on every person listening to this call.
Right.
And every person listening to this podcast, everybody they know. In other words, you and I don't know another human being who isn't being dramatically impacted by this financially.
That's right.
And culturally.
That's right.
Okay. Now, when I'm an investment advisor, and whenever anything has a dramatic impact on money, I want to look at it.
Right.
I want to, pull it up. I want to open it. I want to look inside. I want to say, what is this? Because to me, I can't afford to not know. Right. If there's risk, the greatest way in the world to make money is to not lose money. So if there's risk about, I need to know about it.
That's right.
Now, I have tried for many, many years to try and, get an intelligent conversation going on about, who's really in charge, who's really running things, why are they behaving the way they're behaving? And I kind of feel like as a country, particularly, or North America, is stuck on, an explanation that this is all happening because the leadership is bad. because greedy Goldman Sachs partners cannot engineer. We're talking about something which threads through every aspect of business, technology, government. Greed cannot engineer that. This is much bigger than that.
It is much bigger. I'm certainly not one of those that thinks that there isn't corruption in the system and, that a lot of these banksters should be going to jail. They've taken advantage of something.
They've taken advantage of the system's dependency on them.
And some of them may not even know about this hidden system of finance, and some of them...
Oh, I think a tremendous number of them don't know.
Yeah, and if they were to be told about it, they'd laugh.
Right.
But I'm in the same boat as you are, Catherine. I can't sit down and look at the way that the government responded to the bearer bonds scandals, number one. I cannot sit down and look at trillions of dollars in mortgage fraud and quadrillions of dollars in credit default swaps and other kinds of derivatives and not come to the conclusion that there has to be some load end on this circuit. Because if you look at all of the financial leverage in the system, it should have shown up by now in terms of hyper-Zimbabwe type inflation.
Right.
And it has not.
It has not.
And it's gone somewhere. And it's not simply a matter of zero balancing books. It's not simply a matter of, corporations and banks being awash in cash and they're just not releasing it. It's gone somewhere. And the only explanation I can come to, the electrical circuitry model has been around for a long time in finance. And the only conclusion I can come to is that there is a ground part of this financial circuit, to use the analogy again, that we're not aware of.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, Tesla had it right when he came up with his wireless power transmission. He simply reversed the role of the circuit. It wasn't the ground that was the ground anymore. It was the atmosphere. The ground has been shifted out there, folks.
Well, I, you know, for many, many years, it was because of the experiences I had in the 90s that I really started to learn about the infrastructure. You know, I learned a lot about covert control and how it was engineered. Mm-hmm. And I learned about it in a very personal, intimate way, but in a way where I was reading and studying
right.
and able to map out, literally map out the entire sort of, how is the matrix engineered? There is a matrix. How is it engineered? And I was able to really study and learn that. And so a process started in the 2000s where different financial commentators were going to say, you know, it started in 2000, the dollar's going to collapse, you know, in a month or in 3 months or in six months,
yeah.
but it's going to collapse shortly. And I would say, no, it's not. And sure enough, the dollar would start to drop and then there would be a covert intervention. And
yep.
then the dollar would bounce back up. You know, and this has gone on now for 13 years where
yep.
everyone says the dollar is going to collapse. And I say, no, it's not. And, you know, then there's a covert intervention. And I say, can we talk about this covert intervention? And the door gets absolutely slammed shut on my face.
Yeah.
No, no. Real men don't talk about that.
Well, you know, we can extend that pattern of covert interventions. I mean, my word, let's go all the way back to Nixon taking us off Bretton Woods.
Right.
And I remember at the time, and you probably remember at the time too, there was this prediction of dire financial, you know, apocalypse as a result. The dollar is going to collapse. No one's going to accept it. And exactly what happened in your pattern, the dollar dropped, and then all of a sudden it didn't.
Right.
And this has been going on, as you say, for, you know, at least
a
the last
long
13,
time.
Yeah, a long time.
A long time.
So where is it coming from, and how are they doing this? My guess, Catherine, is that it's coming from people deeply involved in this hidden system of finance, and it's coming from their ability to manipulate bullion. To me, this is the hidden key here. You know, we've seen China buying up gold at just breathtaking rates, attempts of other countries to get their gold repatriated, and now colossally, you know, we're seeing figures of amounts of gold in existence that vary by as much of an order of magnitude from
right.
different
it's,
sources.
It's if you really want to get frustrated, sit down and try and figure out how much the inventory of gold on this planet is.
Oh, it's incredible. I've tried. You know, I did that research for Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations,
yeah.
and I thought, you know, the obfuscation here is deliberate. This is a more covert intervention.
Right.
So, you know, I think what's really happening is we're seeing just this monumental retrenchment into North America. It's slow. It's subtle. But it's also massive. It's definitely
drive around Dallas. It's not so subtle.
Well, I mean in terms of just the national
how the media perception is handled is phenomenally subtle.
Oh, it's incredible.
Yeah,
it's incredible. And you've got this going on. I have a great deal of respect for Paul Craig Roberts, and someone asked him about our retrenchment scenario, and he just said, well, that's ridiculous. He just dismissed it. And, you know, I, with all respect, I don't think that it's capable of being dismissed so easily when you consider all the factors involved here.
So let me give you an example. You have probably not lately looked at a chart of Lockheed Martin.
No.
Lockheed Martin is the largest contractor to the U.S. government. Okay?
Oh, my word.
And so it is, you know, not just number one defense contractor and number one seller of weapons and for sure UFOs. But in fact, we should read the quote. I'm going to use the quote up on the blog post from Ben Rich, who was the head of Lockheed Skunk Works. Do you want to tell him what Ben Rich said?
Well, he said, we found an error in the equations, and now we have the ability to take E.T. home.
But he basically said, you know, if you can think of it, we have it. We already have it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it was incredible. So, wait a minute, where are we? You're going to have to edit this, Justin. Where did I want to go with this? I can't believe it. I just blanked out.
Well, maybe I can help. We're looking at this retrenchment scenario, and we're looking at the
Lockheed Martin stock. So Lockheed Martin is the number one contractor to the American government and the number one defense contractor.
Right.
Okay. Huge, enormous private company, and has been one of the leaders in managing this technology since the beginning of, the Cold War. Okay,
yep.
So we're talking about a real leader operationally at every government agency and with this technology, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we've come through a huge sequestration at the beginning of year in the budget, massive talks of budget cuts. We've just come through another budget war, more talks of budget cuts. Lockheed Martin stock has gone to the moon. Lockheed Martin stock. Every time I look at Lockheed Martin stock, I say, whenever I talk, just as a theoretical matter, about taking $40 trillion, putting in an endowment that can generate $2 trillion a year plus of dividends and interest to basically finance the government on a private basis,
You
look at Lockheed Martin stock and say, has to be. Because they are not behaving like a company who's being affected by the fact that their number one client, is experiencing massive budget cuts. Their stock is flying. And this is traditionally a stock that is flatlined. So something else is going on here.
Well, if that's the case, then I suspect that there have been covert moves on the part of that company with other elites in other countries, other technocratic elites. And I think you might discover that there is a relationship between its stock performance and this story about the U.S. and Russia talking about building a joint asteroid defense system. because if anybody's going to be up front and center, Lockheed is the modern Krupp.
Operationally, if you look at their operational capacity, to a certain when I was Assistant Secretary at HUD, Lockheed ran all the information systems and payment systems, and I used to try and get data from them, and they wouldn't give it to me. So imagine I would ask Lockheed for data on one of the programs I was legally responsible to run, and they'd just say no, and there was nothing I could do.
There's your covert government right there.
Right. So let's, speaking of covert wars, we see last week the dollar was really under tremendous pressure. This NSA scandal is dreadful, of course, for the dollar.
Yes.
And we see the sort of the backing up on Syria. That's not good. We see Obama taking tremendous criticism for Obamacare, a weak president, again, very bad for the dollar. So the dollar is clearly under tremendous pressure. And if the BRICS try and, do separate internet from us and separate cloud from us and then all sorts of separate currency and financial transactions, all really tough on the dollar. So the dollar's really heading down. Suddenly, on Wednesday, now on Friday, we get headlines that we have an earthquake and a typhoon headed for Fukushima.
Yeah.
Okay? But on Wednesday, at the opening, the Japan ETF suddenly plummets. The next day, the market buys it up. I'm sure the market's sitting around saying, well, there's no reason for the ETF. Japanese ETF to trade off like that, it buys up. Then suddenly, of course, announcement of the earthquake typhoon, boom, down on Friday. And then, then the announcement comes out, the earthquake really wasn't a problem, and don't worry about the typhoon. The Chinese announced a $20 billion contract to Boeing for all sorts of new aerospace activities, and then a joint announcement from Boeing and Lockheed that they're going to do a new kind of aerospace project, presumably for the U.S. government. And you look at all these events, boom, 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 and you say, well, wait a minute, there's a story here.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it is. And, of course, the dollar turns and is doing just fine.
Oh, my.
I know. So here's my question. It's one of the reasons I so love your books. We do not know what invisible weaponry stands behind the U.S. dollar. We don't know if it's earthquake technology. We don't know if there's weather control. We don't know if there's all sorts of invisible electromagnetic weapons. We do know that the U.S. Navy to this day controls the sea lanes on, I would say the satellite lanes as well.
Right.
And we do know there's lots of rumors that they have spaceships traveling the galaxy.
Right.
You know, but, and let's presume that they have all the traditional mechanisms of control. We don't know what the invisible weaponry is, but we certainly know that every time we see this dollar issue and we see a defense of the dollar, there's all sorts of funny patterns that say,
yep.
You know, there is invisible. And the reason I've spent so much time trying to understand what I can about the invisible weaponry, even though there's no reliable information, is I can't come up with another hypothesis of what's defending the dollar.
I cannot either. And your model here, I think, is essentially correct. It is the vast military industrial intelligence complex of the United States that ultimately props up the dollar. This is the Venetian system writ large. Pardon me. So that's part of it right there. But the other thing, the Japan thing intrigues me because Japan, like Germany, has been making these, pardon me, all of a sudden my throat went very dry.
What is it when we talk about this, suddenly our throats are tickling?
Well, exactly. I don't know, but I suspect that Japan, like Germany, has been making these very subtle moves diplomatically for about 10 years. And we really see it increasing in Germany's case with an intensity that I never expected to see this quickly after the reunification. Japan, Japan, the yen is part of the special drawing rights that China has been pushing for, and Russia, to make as kind of a alternative world reserve currency. And Japan is very clever. They're not objecting, but they're not pushing, as far as I can tell. Pardon me. So you see this push to close down Fukushima and all of this. I suspect that we're looking at another case where the dollar has been defended against potential moves on the part of some of these countries to bring an end to the reserve status rather quickly.
Well, let me ask you something. Is it possible that one of the issues is, you know, the Japanese moving off of nuclear energy has been a real boon to help keep the oil price up?
Yep.
And so, you know, that's a big piece of the oil trade globally.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And what, is there any relationship with the Japanese threatening to go back and open more nuclear plants?
No. I'll tell you what I suspect may be really at stake here. Japan was, and most people forget this, Japan was one of the countries that very early on went full tilt into big money backing of investigation of cold fusion. Almost as soon as Pons and Fleischmann made their announcement and were chased out of this country in 1989-1990, Japan, METI in Japan, the Ministry of Trade and Import in Japan, immediately, I think to the tune of $100 to $200 million, decided it was going to fund cold fusion research, and they've been doing so ever since. And if you look at some of the reports on alternative energy technologies, the Japanese have every now and then they've come out with these little reports. Like just prior to Fukushima, they were reporting on a car that they wanted to produce
running
that ran
water.
Out of water.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we're looking at attempts of countries to break out of the Anglo-American orbit. And Japan was certainly one of them. They were making noises about trying to bury the hatchet with the Chinese. I think this could be
there's no way the Anglo-American lines can allow that.
Oh, no, not yet.
Right.
You know, not yet, certainly. They're on a timetable, and I think they realize they can't keep the dollar propped up forever. But they can't afford it to have, you know, go down the tanks now.
Right.
That's the problem. This is why this whole Merkel thing, you mentioned in your outline, the NSA invasive surveillance, I think this is the other part of it. I think that you're looking at, and we've both, I think, are agreed that this surveillance thing isn't about terrorism, it's about finances.
Right.
And it's a mechanism to prop up the dollar. It's an insider trading mechanism. This is why I think the situation with Chancellor Merkel is really
very, very dangerous.
It's dangerous. It's bizarre.
Well, if the Russians and the Germans get together with the Chinese who are getting together with Japan, you got a real problem.
Yeah, you've got.
And I mean, we see Cameron come out at the very same time this week saying they'll do Shariah compliant financing for the UK.
Oh, well,
that's quite a nod from the Anglo-American Alliance.
This NSA thing, Catherine, bothers me because, you know,
it's very dangerous. Well, here's the thing. The Americans, and I, you know, you see this all along. The Americans keep forgetting that there is this thing called the Mandate of Heaven.
Yep.
And if you're going to do something this invasive, then you better not get caught.
Yeah.
You better not get caught because you are going to lose the Mandate of Heaven. And then you've got a real problem, because getting that back is very hard.
It's very hard. And the other thing is, you know, Europe is, if you look at Europe, it's the world's biggest economy.
Right.
And the locomotive driving Europe since, you know, the creation of the German Empire in the 19th century is Germany.
Well, how much of this, when the U.S. and Europe announced they were going to do the trade negotiations, so you've got U.S., Canada, and Europe saying they're going to come much closer together.
Right.
You know, the mother load of, you know, GATT talks.
Right.
You know, rumors going around saying they really are going to get together within a year. How much of it is people saying, no, we got to bust that up?
I suspect, and I'm glad you asked that question, because this is coming from Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Right.
This whole move.
Right.
And I suspect, and I even blogged about it, I forget when, it's been a couple of weeks, but I suspect very strongly that this was a desperate attempt by the American component of that financial elite to keep Europe within the American orbit. And the danger, and Zbigniew Brzezinski said it best in his book, The Grand Chessboard, the real reason for the creation of NATO, he just comes right out and says it. It was not to contain communism. It was
to keep Germany in the fold.
Yeah, bingo. Yeah. Exactly. It was.
Yeah,
to
that's
deal
what the
with,
euro was to keep.
And that's yes, that's what the euro was to keep Germany in the fold. Well, you know, that kind of backfired, because what it really did is it put Germany in the position of being kind of the financial taskmaster to the rest of Europe.
Right.
And the only other thing that is left for the Germans is, as the euro is falling apart, well, they've got to make moves and overtures to Russia and China, which they've done. And now, to add bitterness to all of this, you let it out, or Snowden let it out, that, oh, by the way, we're spying on Chancellor Merkel. You know, Catherine, I just have to laugh because the last time...
Well, I'm sure the Germans are spying on us, you know.
Well, of course they are. You know, this is not news, and nobody expects that they're not. You know, the French are spying on us, and, you know. But the real problem here is, as we've been discussing this scenario, if you look in the last 2 weeks, increasingly Russia Today, Ed Snowden, even some sources in the UK like The Guardian or the Daily Torygraph, as I like to call it, even these sources are coming out and pointing out that the real reason for the NSA spying is financial.
Right.
And Der Spiegel even ran an article about this.
This is economic warfare. This is an
economic warfare
operation, and it's an insider trading operation. And you know something? It's very good.
Yeah, and the problem is now... What I'm suggesting is, because you find the European nations running stories like this, they're sending messages that they're not going to play that game.
Right.
In other words, the playing field better be leveled, or we're going to level it for you. this is really what's behind the BRICS moves to create their own internet.
Here's a question. How, you know, can you imagine running an American cloud company right now?
Oh, heavens, no.
You've just had your entire global market pulled out from under you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, ugh.
Companies are outsourcing their data storage now because no one trusts this country.
Right.
So, you know, this has been a huge mess. And between you and me, Catherine, I'm only going to predict that it's going to get worse.
That is going to get
better.
Worse.
Huh?
It is going to get worse. And here's, but this has been growing for many decades, which is, Are we going to use the financial markets for economic warfare? Are we going to use them to transact?
Right. Exactly.
Because at some point, what the NSA scandal is about is we're reaching a tipping point.
Yes, exactly.
Now, here's my question. If you look at everything that is happening in North America with the agriculture, with the transportation, with the energy self-sufficiency, with the rollout of new technology, which we really haven't touched on too much, but you look at all of that, can this be done with this much pushback from the rest of the world without some popularity in the or some support from the general population? And if you look at what's going on with Obamacare and with a variety of different policies, sort of increase in the dropping or doing the changes in the payroll tax and the increase in Social Security, I mean, they're basically wiping out pretty much the working classes, the working classes, basically, you know, their discretionary income.
Well,
seems to me they're attacking on all sides. It's a little bit like Napoleon going to Russia.
Yeah, they are, but the problem is they may think that it will work by wiping out the working class and doing all of this while they're retrenching and everything else, but it won't. That's just once again the reality of markets. It will not and cannot be sustained. I don't think, however, that may necessarily be in the cards, because the blowback, I think, that's going to happen and is happening around the world as a result of the exposure of this NSA financial economic warfare, is, I think America is, let me put it this way, I think the elite has already concluded that they have lost Europe in the sense that they will no longer be as subservient as they have been. And to top it off, the last time we made an enemy of Germany
was not good.
It was
well,
not
and
good.
We've had Germany under our thumb since then.
And yes.
You know, point to demonstrate it is we've had their gold.
Yeah, and that's not going to last either. I think the failure to turn over the gold, as far as the German elite was concerned, was the last straw. And I think that, you know, no self-respecting German government is going to knuckle under to that extent. And this is why I think you see them playing this very careful, you know, traditional German diplomacy that we haven't really seen since Frederick the Great. Balance of power between the East and the West. But
okay, so this is why I keep coming back to the weapons, because we're talking about a situation where, you know, increasingly what we're saying is the Anglo-American alliance, one advantage is their invisible weaponry.
Well, here's the problem with Germany. And most people aren't aware, and those who are tend to dispute my scenario here. But Germany, I've been arguing and believing that Germany has been a closet nuclear power since at least the late 1970s. And
it has to be.
Oh, yeah. And here's why. Let's go back to late 1979. The Carter administration accused South Africa of detonating a bomb. The South Africans denied it. Well, this began a process of research from some New York Times journalists who studied the whole thing, and they concluded that West Germany and South Africa and Israel were in a partnership to develop a bomb, which South Africa did. Now, turn the dial forward to today. Germany builds nuclear submarines for Israel, okay, that are capable of launching cruise missiles and nuclear-equipped cruise missiles to boot. So in other words, Germany has the technology to do this. On top of that, most people are not aware of this, but we all know that France is a thermonuclear power. France has just brought online its new ballistic submarine ICBM launched missile, all right? Now, this is a missile carrying MIRVed hydrogen bomb warheads. Who builds that missile? For the French. It's the Germans.
Right.
And they're building the warheads. Okay. So in other words.
Well, and, you know, to make matters worse, if you look at the meltdown in Russia in the 90s, yeah. You know, for sure the Russian mafia has a nuclear weapon. Right.
Sure. And, you know, you are not going to be a self-respecting German government and not have this kind of military capability. But let's add something else to the mix here. When the reunification happened, most people don't remember this, but when the reunification happened, nobody seemed to object. And the question is, why? Why didn't the Soviet Union, which had very good reason to mistrust Germany, called World War II, why did they not say a thing? Well, one of the things I suspect, and here's your Fukushima scenario, writ large. If you recall, at the time, Soviet Georgia, the home of the then Soviet foreign minister, Eduard Shevardnadze, experienced a massive earthquake.
Hmm.
This happened as the reunification was happening.
Right.
And, you know, Helmut Kohl literally didn't even bother to consult Washington or London or Paris. He just went ahead and pointed the gun at East Germany and said, "You're coming in." And the interesting thing, more recently, we had that strange Norway spiral episode. You know, Germany has its own version of HAARP. This is what most people don't realize. And, you know, it's dressed up like everything else in Europe as a pan-European effort. But you scratch and sniff behind it, and it's German. It's just like the European Space Agency downloading all their photos to Germany. You had this episode of the Norway spiral where the European version of HAARP was turned on at the same time the Russians were testing a missile which got zapped. And at the same time, and again, connecting dots here, at the same time, President Obama was over there in Europe receiving his Nobel Peace Prize for doing what, we don't know. But he was over there getting his Nobel Peace Prize and also to pitch the U.S. missile defense system. Remember what Angela Merkel told him?
No.
We don't need it.
Spoken like a true German physicist, a true German physicist.
Yes, we don't need it. So we've got our own, in other words. So, you know, like it or not, you know, I think Germany, like it or not, it may continue to be in a subservient role to the U.S., but it's not going to be to the degree it was.
So what we're talking about when we look at the dollar and so much of the management of the G7 economies,
right,
is we're looking at military questions.
Yes, and, I think so.
And so I, for one, would love to have some ongoing discussion, conversation about those military questions. But I can't get the financial commentators interested in doing it. It's, oh, no, we don't want to go there. Well,
it's
how can
taboo.
You not go there?
Yeah, it's taboo because I think the reason why, Catherine, is they don't want people to make the connection that what is propping up the dollar is the military. But after we get done tonight, I'm going to do my, you know, usual Thursday night news and views, and I'm going to be talking about an article that kind of puts it right out there on the line, and it's about the U.S. dollar reserve status and why the Chinese don't want reserve status. Okay, and
well, that they certainly totally, don't. Yeah. Oh.
They don't. Of course not.
Of course not.
But you look at.
They just launched their first aircraft carrier. Are you kidding?
Well, listen. Talk about aircraft carriers. Japan just launched one.
I know.
About 2 months ago.
And, so now we're ready to have a war in the South China Sea.
Well, they're not calling it an aircraft carrier in Japan. It's not a hospital ship.
It's a peace ministry.
It's a peace ministry. Well, you know, what we're doing, the bottom line, Catherine, is what we're doing is we're managing to piss off some very powerful allies. And Germany and Japan, it seems to me that the last time we did it didn't work out too well for anybody concerned. But
the other thing is fighting can't get us out of this.
No, of course not. It won't.
Right. And we don't want to go into it, but it's funny. It was just that we had a subscriber lunch in San Francisco, and somebody asked a very good question. You know, did you enjoy the Breakthrough Energy Conference, and do you really believe any of this stuff exists? And I said, look, all the scientists and inventors who I know who seem to be credible people, and the credible people I know say it exists, I don't know. I'm an investment advisor. What do I know? I said, but, you know, I've seen UFOs, and there are thousands of sightings of UFOs. I mean, this is a documented phenomena. They are not running on fossil fuel.
No.
They are not running on. Somebody's got this.
Right.
So that has that alone has profound implications for the economy of the whole planet.
And, you know, before I get back to what I was going to say about this article and reserve status, we've got something else. We've got that Nazi scientist down in Argentina in the 1950s telling the United States Air Force that sent people down to interview him after our little hydrogen bomb mishap that... Yeah, you know, I'm achieving nuclear fusion reactions at less than the normal thermal gradient, and I'm doing so using rotation and stress and electrical stress and lithium 7 and all sorts of fun stuff. And I believe that the reason I'm getting this is because it's an interaction with the energy of the medium of space time.
Right.
That's where the energy is coming from. That's what he comes right out and tells them. And, of course, everybody laughs, ha, 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 another Nazi nut. And, you know, and here's the problem. If you look into cold fusion, which back in the 1980s was laughed out of the United States over to France and over to Japan and over to Germany, if you look at it, they have now come up with a scientifically acceptable to the mainstream scientists theory, and it's called lattice-assisted nuclear reaction. Well, if you go back, go to my book, The Nazi International, and read what what Dr. Ronald Richter told the U.S. Air Force at the time. He told them that he's getting these reactions by means of some mechanism of coupling with what he called the cellular structure of space. In other words, the lattice.
Right.
It was a lattice assist. So in other words, he's thinking conceptually. In the early 1950s, along the same lines, that now, 50 years later, is public and mainstream. So this tells me, yeah, this technology went deeply black in the American Black Projects, probably continued to be so in some Nazi project somewhere, because, you know, here's this guy down in Argentina doing this, and he's getting the money from somewhere. And Juan Perón doesn't have enough on his own to do it.
Right.
So, in other words, yeah, this stuff has been around. This energy technology exists. But listen to the reserve status currencies in the last 600 years, going back to 1400. Listen to the countries that had it. Portugal, Spain, the Netherlands, France, Great Britain, and now finally us.
Right.
So in other words, what you're looking at here, folks, I think is a very interesting pattern. You're looking at, number one, world empires. So reserve currency status puts you in world empire mode.
Which is expensive.
And it's expensive. And look at something else at each of these empires: Portugal, Spain, the Netherlands, France, Britain, and the United States. Each of these empires had either vast colonial empires and experienced massive inflation at home, with the corresponding loss of their industrial base, or in Portugal and the Netherlands case, they sustained world empires just like the USA does, on the Venetian model of having little trading outposts here and there and military bases here and there.
And so a super-duper navy.
Yeah, and a super-duper navy. You know.
And I'll tell you one of the secrets of Venice, and we won't go into it tonight, but they essentially invented the insurance industry.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so they found ways of allocating and managing the risk of all the different trade and expeditions that would, you know, so that a bad patch wouldn't take down the whole system.
And you know what else they invented? You know what else they invented?
What?
Double entry accounting.
Yes. Oh, yep. Well, that, you know, that's, it's always information technology that makes the new phase go.
Yep.
So, but, well, you combine, in the 1400s, you combine printing with double entry bookkeeping, and suddenly you're going to see an explosion globally.
Oh,
and that's why
funny.
If you look at the whole internet payment mechanism, which we'll talk about next time when we talk about financial vipers.
Oh, boy. I have a suspicion I know what you're thinking. I have a suspicion I'm agreed with you.
Well, you know something, there's nothing I love more. One of the reasons I love my job is I get to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
Well, it is so refreshing to have a free, you know, we need to be able to go into the invention room and think about these things and figure them out, because we don't know. We don't know.
I totally agree, and I think, you know, I think people have to hear this kind of thinking, because I'm with you. If you're sitting around watching CNN or Fox,
it's too weird.
It's too weird. And to try and make sense of it along normal lines,
it's not possible.
I mean, my word, we just went through a political meltdown in this country where neither party can even listen to each other.
Right.
And, you know, it's like I went to sleep in Norman Rockwell's America and woke up and I...
I keep sounding like a broken record on this. I wrote an article called Coming Clean More Over the Fiscal Cliff, and where I explained the 22 structural problems why the budget was, you know, basically stuck.
Right.
And it's because... without an honest conversation about the things we're talking about,
right,
you can't re-engineer the budget.
No, you can't.
You have too many people who have too little understanding of the fundamental cash flows of the overt budget, let alone the covert budget.
Right, right. Well, you know, we are dealing, I think it was you that said this, or it may have been Richard Dolan, pardon me, I don't remember, but... We really are dealing with not just a two-tiered society. We're dealing with a two-tiered government.
Right.
We've got the deep structure. We've got, you know, Peter Dale.
And the government's not in control.
And the government's not in control.
They don't control the technology. The corporate, the private investors do.
Right. The government, the one that we think of, you know, in the district of corruption, that is assuming all the risks and liabilities, but has no control or say.
Right. I remember I had that job. I was legally responsible, and I was blamed for everything, but I didn't have the operational control and power I needed to implement.
And you couldn't even get the information.
Right. I couldn't get the data from Lockheed.
You know, this is what I keep trying to get people to wake up to. As long as they're thinking in terms of living in a normal republic where their voice counts and they're represented, then it's not going to make sense. But if they start to think of things in terms of an elite, an oligarchy, a technocracy, and this is why I think Venice is so important, because you've got the outward trappings of state and then you've got the reality,
right?
Which is completely...
Well, and, you know, we're talking about something that's very big and it's been going on for a long time, so everybody's a prisoner of the system. It's not like somebody has the power to just, let me turn the ship.
Exactly. So, you know, it's people can go on blaming Bush or Obama or Clinton or whoever, but, you know, these people are the sock puppets and figureheads on the stage. It's like you say, you're dealing with a hidden system of finance, and that means that the budget system is going to be intractable if you're trying to fix it solely on the basis or from the standpoint of the overt government and of the overt structure of the state.
Well, think of it. If you are running the system, we have just passed the point where the number of people on means-tested subsidy is now greater than the number of people working.
Yeah.
And you've got to go out and get the money to cover their subsidy every week.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Ultimately, it won't work. And I think now, as we've been discussing, I think the elite has at least realized that they can't continue that game for very much longer. And they're putting in the steps, but to bring things back home. But the reasons they're doing so, again, I think you and I are on the same page here. The reasons ultimately are still hidden, and
right.
They're not ultimately probably anything to do with this earth.
Right, right. Well, before we close down, I'd love you to just give a brief description of Financial Vipers. And I want to remind everybody that the book we've been discussing is Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, UFOs, Oligarchs, and Space Secrecies. You won't be able to put it down. Do not start it on a weeknight.
Well, Financial Vipers is Financial Vipers of Venice is the second in the series of books I had planned, Catherine, on banking and its relationship to physics and politics and you know, elites. It's the second in a series that began with Babylon's Banksters, and it's kind of one of those books like a stone in the arch. It's moving toward a keystone, which will be the next couple books in the series I've been working on researching now. But and incidentally, that book that you sent me.
Oh, I had to get that for you. And let me just explain. I got Pieces of Eight, which is the definitive monetary history of the United States by Edwin Vieira. I took one look at your bookshelf and I said, this man must own a copy of Pieces of
Well,
Eight.
I want to thank you very much for that. I've been reading that. And, it is, all I can tell you is it's like a piece of the jigsaw puzzle that you knew was there that no one was supplying.
Right.
Well, you just supplied a huge piece for the jigsaw puzzle.
Well, thank Edwin Vieira, because that took years of intense scholarship.
I can tell. I'm gobsmacked, as the British say, by the amount of.
Ladies and gentlemen, remember this is a man who went to Oxford. So.
Well, yeah, the amount of. Folks, we're talking about a 1,400-page, two-volume tome.
Right.
It's just truly astonishing. And it confirms some of my suspicions that that we are wildly, wildly off. You know, you know me. I'm not a medalist, but on the other hand, I certainly think that money and bullion particularly constitutes a means of giving money value.
Right.
That was the big point I was trying to make in Babylon's Banksters. You've got money, which represents a medium of exchange for value, and then you've got the facsimile of money, which is always monetized debt. And he's filling in a lot of pieces there in that story. But Financial Vipers of Venice, I wrote that, Catherine, because I wanted people to understand that the system that we are in has so many parallels with Venice.
Right.
Particularly since 9/11 and the massive expansion of the national security state and some of the draconian powers that have now accrued to the executive branch. They are mirror images of what the Venetians put into place at the height of their power and when that power was under threat. And it's interesting that as they saw the Venetian state begin to decline, they closed out they closed out the public debt. They brought up their own personal liquidity and transferred their base of operations.
Right.
And in a certain sense, what we've been talking about with this retrenchment scheme is we're seeing a similar thing. They're closing out the books, they're writing off the debt, paying it off, bringing the money in the manufacturing back. So it's kind of the same scenario in that sense, but not the same in that they've decided they can't relocate, so we'd better do something with with Dehaimat, you know, with the homeland. So
right, and they're trying to lower their risk domestically with control.
Yes, yeah.
And I think we need to find, you know, if you look at crowdfunding and other things, that's an effort to reduce their risk, you know, by the nice, not rough method.
Right.
And what we all need to be thinking about is, okay, what's really going on and how do we start reducing the risk across the board?
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It does no one any good if they resort to the rough methods.
Right.
And ultimately, it doesn't do them any good either, because usually those methods ultimately fail. So, yeah, I'm totally agreed. But I wrote it, you know, to kind of get people to think in terms of how do oligarchies work? What's the relationship between finance and physics, which to me has always been a big, huge part of the story, an untold part of the story. So, yeah, it's an interesting little book.
The one of the things I really like about it is it gets into the much deeper issues,
yeah,
even spiritual issues of money,
yeah.
You know, sort of deep finance.
Yeah.
And that's an important conversation once you have the conversation of governance, because,
oh yes, absolutely.
You know, nothing drives me crazy faster than the financial commentators trying to fiddle with the currency system without discussing, well, what's the governance structure under which it will function. Because
yep,
to me, it's just a piece of the governance structure. And if you try and do it blind without looking at the governance structure, then you get terrible, terrible
you
mess.
Can't, yes, exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that, because in Babylon's Banksters, I put the question to people that money is not simply a representation of something. It's a representation of someone.
Right. It's our covenant with each other.
It's our covenant with each other. And if people don't understand this, you know, money has represented different people at different times. And whenever money is the representative of an individual or just a few or a monopoly, it doesn't work.
Right.
That's the huge problem.
Right. That's where we are.
That's where we are.
So exactly. In closing, I want to give you two quotes for our situation. One which I had never seen before, but I found in your book that I absolutely love, we're going to put it up on the blog, was from Jacques Vallée. For the propulsion system inside a flying saucer may well be as ludicrous as opening up the hood of a car to find out where the horse is hidden.
Yep.
And you know, one of the reasons I like it is when you try and talk about what's going to happen to the dollar or any of the financial markets within the current official reality construct,
yeah,
it's exactly that. It's like looking for the horse inside of the
yep
hood of a car.
Yep.
The other one is brings me back to this idea of, you know, this is quite a stress situation and we need to bring the risk down. It's from Rumi. It says, sit down and be quiet. You are drunk and this is the edge of the roof.
That's good. That's too true. Oh, my word, that's too true.
Anyway, well, Joseph Farrell, you know, I can't tell you what a privilege it is to have you on the Salieri Report, to know you, to be in cahoots, to enjoy your wonderful books. I recommend to everybody that these are two books. All of your books are wonderful. As I said, I have them all piled up in my den. And we'll be back a quarter from now, but I just want to mention I'm going to get the privilege of having dinner with you on my way back from California in November. And as usual, I can't wait.
Wonderful. I look forward to it.
So mention again, if anybody doesn't know your website, mention again your website, how to find you.
My website is www.GizaDeathStar.com. That's all one word, all lowercase, GIZA, and then the word DeathStar.com. And then I have a Facebook page under my name, Joseph Patrick Farrell, so that people can get a hold of me there, and they can actually get the books right off my website as well.
Great. Okay. Dr. Joseph Farrell, you have a wonderful evening.
And you too. And thanks for having me back on, Catherine. It's been fun talking, as it always is.
We're going to figure it out.
And we're going to do it.
Bye.
Bye-bye.